The sun is dissolving like an enchantment as I stand at the ferry railing and look out on the San Francisco horizon. The day will end jubilant. Jubilant. This is the word I chose this morning from Dad's book of words, and I have been keen to use it since breakfast. My father wrote that jubilant means you feel as though you finally possess everything you've always wanted. You are that happy. I like the way the word rolls off my tongue when I say it. I want to believe the day will end on a jubilant note. I am counting on it. Most of the ferry's passengers aren't on the deck watching the golden sun fold itself into the western rim of the sky. They are seated inside, out of the bracing wind. But I don't want to be tucked indoors after 6 long days on a train. I close my eyes as the heady fragrance of the ocean transports me, as if in a dream, to Graham's cottage in Donaghadee above the slate Irish sea. I can see the house in my mind's eye, just as it was when I was young, back when life was simple. I can see Graham making me a cup of sugared tea in her kitchen, while a harbour breeze tickles the lace curtains she made from her wedding dress 2 days after marrying my Anglican grandfather. On the kitchen table are shortbread cookies arranged on the daisy plate and still warm from the oven. She is humming an old Gaelic tune. But no, I've spent too many hours pondering what I wouldn't do to go back in time to Graham's kitchen, what I'd be willing to give up, what I'd be willing to give. I open my eyes to behold again the nearness of the San Francisco docks. Backward glances are of no use to me now. I move away from the railing to the shelter of an overhang and tuck loose strands of hair back into place. I don't want to step off the ferry looking like a street urchin. Not today. I look down at my skirt to see how bad the wrinkles are, not too noticeable in the day's diminishing light. My journey from New York to California took place on a second-class seat, not in a private sleeping car, hence the creases. I'd not expected anything different, as Martin Hocking had written that he is in good financial standing, not that he is rich. That he has means of any amount is miracle enough. I would have ridden in the baggage car all the way to get out of the umbrella factory and the tenement, and especially away from young Irish women just like me, who reminded me too frequently of what I left back home. If my mother could see me now, she'd no doubt put me on the first train back to New York. But then Mam doesn't know how bad it was. I didn't want to worry her, so she doesn't know that the room I was subletting with 4 flatmates was no bigger than a kitchen pantry, and that a single spigot in the back alley provided the only water to drink, bathe, and cook with for the entire building. She doesn't know everyone dumped their chamber pots out their windows because there were no indoor toilets, despite city ordinances requiring them, and that the stink of human waste hung on the air like a drape. The tenement wasn't a place to come home to at the end of the workday. It was just a shared room with sagging mattresses, a place where dreams for a better life could unravel faster than your threadbare clothes, and where girls like me from Belfast and Armagh and Derry and other Irish towns lay their heads at night. I had a neighbour lady in Chicago when I was growing up who was from Ireland. A woman seated across from me said hours earlier, as our train chuffed through the Nevada desert, "She came to America as a young girl during that terrible time when there was nothing to eat in Ireland and nothing would grow. That was years ago. I wasn't even born yet. So that was long before you were alive." She told me it was something awful that time. Whole families starved to death. The woman shook her head in pity. There isn't a soul back home who hasn't heard of those long years of scarcity. Everyone in County Down called that time the Great Famine. Graham, who defiantly spoke Gaelic until her dying breath, called it and Gertha Moore. The Great Hunger. As if to say it wasn't the lack of food that is remembered, but how that stretch of years made people feel, ravenous and empty and wanting. "Yes, I've been told 'twas a terrible time," I replied. The woman then asked if I'd immigrated to America with my whole family. I thought of Mason, my brother who came to America first and sponsored me, and who is now living somewhere in Canada with a woman he fell in love with. No, just me.
You came all by yourself?
The woman said.
I think that's very brave, and you're so young.
I smiled at this because some days I feel as though I've already lived several lifetimes, and others as though I haven't lived any kind of life at all, that I'm still waiting for it to start, or waiting for it to start over. I answered I was 20, nearly 21.
What lovely cheekbones you have, and such beautiful black hair,
the woman continued. I didn't know Irish had black hair. I thought you were all redheads and blondes and auburns. And then the woman asked what was bringing me all the way from New York to San Francisco.
So many reasons.
I gave her the easy one. I'm getting married. The woman offered me her congratulations and asked what my future husband's name was. As she did so, I realized I was itching to have someone older and wiser tell me I was making a sensible choice, an understandable one, considering how hard and complicated the world is. His name is Mr. Martin Hocking. Would you like to see his picture? The woman smiled and nodded. I reached into my handbag and pulled out the photograph Martin had mailed to me. He was dressed in a vested pinstripe suit, his wavy hair gelled into place, and his trimmed moustache partly covering his lips. He wore a fixed, charismatic gaze that I'd gotten lost in every time I looked at it. I'd had the photograph for less than 2 weeks, but I knew its every inch.
My, oh my, but he is handsome, the woman said. Such striking eyes. He looks like he could see into your very soul.